Okay, good morning, everybody. My name's Damien. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to day two of Fellowship of the Spirit, International Easter Lockdown 2020. We have an awesome program for you today, beginning with KDP will be speaking for us in a moment. We prayed our way out last night with the Lord's Prayer, so I will ask Cherie to help us pray our way back into today, and we will finish the session off at the end of today with the Lord's Prayer. I'll just share that with everybody, so feel free to pray along with us or just listen and read.
God, our Creator, please help us set aside everything we think we know about the world around us and current events, so that we may have open hearts, minds, and spirits. Let us be assured that you are here among us, the one who has all power, and that you approve of what we are doing. Have us know in our hearts that you give us this spiritual, give this spiritual gathering your blessing, that we should give of ourselves in service, in love, and in fellowship. Bless all our speakers with the knowledge that it is you who has all wisdom. It is you who bestows all gifts. It is you who has granted them the wonderful privilege of sharing their experiences in being restored to sanity and given us all a life better than we could have possibly imagined. Bless our committee, our many volunteers, and even our internet connections, so we may all share and connect fully in the fellowship of the Spirit. We humbly ask you this as we set forth, safe in the knowledge that you love, accept, and encourage us all. Amen.
Thanks, Cherie. It's now my pleasure to hand this morning session over to our host for the morning, who is Bobby and Jason.
Hello, my name is Bobby and I'm an alcoholic.
Jason, I am an alcoholic.
And everyone, welcome to the Fellowship of the Spirit International Easter Lockdown on day two. First, we're going to give you a brief overview of our meetings for today. First, we have an awesome speaker, KDP, who will be sharing her story with us. Then we'll cover steps 8 and 9, followed by steps 10 and 11. And then we'll have our workshop titled Relationships in Lockdown. Will you please join us in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. First up, we have KDP from Austin, Texas. We're excited to see her, hear her message, so help us welcome her.
Hi guys, Katie Parker, alcoholic. It's a treat to be here. Fellowship of the Spirit has got a very special place in my heart. And I have to tell you, when Damien contacted me, he wanted me to speak. I think I was going to be the opening speaker, which would have just been a mere 11 p.m. my time. And I'm like, buddy, I'd love to do it, but that is way too late for me. And he managed to make everything work. So thank you so much, Damien, for all you've done. And Cherie, we got an opportunity to meet them, and they are just real pioneers. You know, I love that. I love the people behind the scenes. They're the doer. And so I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And wow, Cherie, what a prayer. I got enough minute to click that picture of that on the screen. That was absolutely remarkable. Spoke really, really to my soul. So thank you for that. I do want to thank everybody that's involved in getting these things together. I like to start out by saying at first, the first time I heard about the Zoom meetings was, you know, right when we were all getting, you know, quarantined And my very first thought was, I am not doing a Zoom meeting. Are you kidding me? You know that, and I'm 62 and blah, 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 blah. And I mean, it wasn't 10 minutes. I went into prayer and meditation, you know, my normal routine in the morning. And I mean, I heard the booming voice of God. And I've only heard booming like twice in my sobriety. Was, oh, you absolutely will do these and you will be a part of them and you will participate in them. And it was like, okay, excuse me. And so here I am. And, you know, I've been a part of several of these meetings. And I have to tell you, once again, contempt prior to investigation is my middle name. You know, I'm blown away by how quick my response is and how the undeniable voice of God will tell me I'm off the mark and move me back on. I've been sober since October the 28th of 1984, and for that I am truly grateful. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 26 years old. I had a 5-year-old daughter. I was a single mom, and I was mad as hell. I was angry, angry, angry. I loved my daughter with all my heart, but she was an anchor. You know, she stopped my partying. She stopped my drinking or stopped everything. And I continued. And so I like to say I know pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. I knew I was stepping so far outside my values. I mean, that's just not hard to know. It doesn't even matter how you were raised, is you have these innate values in you. And you know, when the book tells me that a mere code of moral or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have stopped long ago. I get that. I know exactly what that's talking about. And so I like to say, when I start, I can't stop, and I can't stop starting. I'm a speaker who likes to talk about being sober. I don't like to spend any time in my drinking. I find the place for that is me when I'm knee to knee with another drunk. Is to share my story. And I touch it briefly, but the rest is about me being sober for 35 years. I just turned 62 last week in quarantine. I love getting older. You know, I'm one of the small group people who loves getting older. I always tell the people who don't like getting older, you're going to have to work on that because you're getting older. And there's a lot of great things about getting older. And I love the knowledge. I love the knowledge and the experience of life. And I've had a lot of it, right? And I've been sober longer than I was drinking. And but I also like to say, you know, if you're ever in Austin, I've had so many different experiences in recovery. If you're ever in Austin, our home group is the primary purpose group. It meets on Tuesday nights at 7:30 Central Standard Time. And it meets at 2701 South Lamar. And we study the big book line by line, week after week on Tuesday nights. And to me, my husband likes to say it's a lot more fun than it sounds. And it is fascinating. I mean, the one thing that we do that's a little different than other meetings is that we study the text based on what the founders found necessary to teach. And so we're not so much interested in your experience, not that there's anything wrong with your experience, but at this particular meeting, we're trying to come out of what they were trying to tell us. And it's a fascinating meeting. We've been meeting for 14 years, and we have 250 people in Austin, Texas studying the book. And I find that fascinating. And I was never very much into education. I did get my diploma. I didn't learn squat. And no fault but my own. There is never any blame in my game. I'm real clear that my problems are of my own making. But I just wasn't interested in school. I saw school as social. And so when you handed me a book when I got sober, I'm like, whatever. I'm not interested in a book. And so I tried to skip as many parts of this book as I possibly can. And now that we have this big book study and we're studying the doctor's opinion, the first 164 pages of the big book, let me tell you, I know that big book forward and backwards. And the best part is I live it. You know, it's funny. The big book, I always like to say, if you love the book, great. And if you don't love the book, great. Let's not stand in the way of each other, right? Let's just let each person do their own thing. The big book people want to whack the people who don't like the book, and people that don't like the book want to whack these people. There's no fighting in the light. lifeboat, okay? We're all in this deal together. So I happen to be somebody who loves the book today. I didn't ever dislike the book. I found it irrelevant. You know, that was that. I remember having that thought. You know, I did my major house cleaning and then I was like, that's that. And so today, what I understand, and this was a big misunderstanding I had, and like I said, there's no blame in my game. Nobody was telling me this. This mind of mine comes up with its own ideas all the time. And so this is what I thought. I thought that AA was about not drinking, and it was 1984, so that's when codependency, you know, was the big word. What color's your parachute? You know, Bradshaw and all his stuff, and nothing wrong with that, but I thought that was about recovery, right? Codependency group therapy I did for 10 years. Then the other one was that church, I'm kind of a Western religion kind of girl, that church was about finding God. Now, nobody told me this. This is all what came in my mind. You know, when it says the alcoholic cannot differentiate the truth from the false, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one, is I make these decisions. They just come to me and I make them. And so here's what I misunderstood. So AA was about not drinking. And I worked a program based on the abstinence of alcohol for about almost 3 years. And I had no idea that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my trouble. I remember when I read that part of the book, I thought, hey, man, I was voted most likable in high school 4 years in a row. Okay, let's just take a moment on that. Yeah, that's me. And I'm a really likable person. So how can this likable person be selfish and self-centered? Now, many of y'all know my husband, Charlie Parker. Well, Charlie Parker was my best friend for 20 years. And let me tell you, we were like brother and sister. We are the yin and the yang. And I would watch Charlie and I think, well, now he's self-centered. Not me, but Charlie Parker is clearly self-centered. And I remember those thoughts. All this came to me after many years about being in the program. And so the codependency therapy was really, I really think therapy is a real gift. However, one of the things that happens in therapy is it's all about self. It's self-fixing self. And if you're alcoholic, that's not going to work real well for you. So here's the deal. In an inventory process, if you are, your name, you know, somebody's in column one, that's what's going to happen in counseling. Who you mad at? My dad. What did he do? I'm going to tell you what he did. And then column three is how it affected me, my self-esteem, my pride, my ambition. But unfortunately, they don't ever get to column four, right? Column four is all about me. How was I self-righteous, self-centered, self-seeking, self-reliant, you know, afraid, dishonest? So I always say, if you do counseling, be sure you take that to your counselor, because otherwise we tend to lean on these areas of boundaries and detachment. Very dangerous for the alcoholic. That was my experience. I'm telling you, I had a relationship with my father that, you know, I always say parents that have siblings or have children like them usually fight the most. So my dad and I were cut from the same cloth. We were exactly alike and we fought like cats and dogs. And so up into my 10 years of sobriety, my dad and I were still fighting like crazy because in therapy, I felt like it was my dad's fault. I really did. I felt like all my problems were because of my father. Blah, 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 blah. And I thought I was working a great AA program, and come to find out I wasn't touching it. You know, I like that on page 19, it says most of us sense the real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints are basically my guiding light. As an ex-problem drinker, my very life depends upon the constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. I mean, there's no mincing any words there, guys. This is all about I either have to ask for forgiveness or forgive, period. That's really what it boils down to. And I always like to say, you know, the guy in your home group that you can't stand. Okay, let me let you think about that for a second. Okay, that's probably long enough, huh? Okay, let's go ahead and say, five people in your home group you can't stand. Okay, that person in your home group is actually your guiding light. Why? Is because I'm going to do a piece of inventory on him, and I'm going to get down to the causes and conditions. And why does that individual bother me? Because that guy is going to be your boss. He's going to be your neighbor. He's going to be your daughter's husband. I mean, there is so much work in the rub in life is my greatest gift, right? There's many places in the book that say that on page 133, the deliberate manufacture of misery. God didn't do it, but when trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it. You know, my gosh. So that basically says whoever's bothering you is a good thing. I think we delusionally, and I like to say long-term sobriety can be very, very seductive. We delusionally think we arrive, right? I don't know why on this Zoom I'm doing all these air quotes I've never done before in my life, and I've caught myself doing that 100 times. Okay, so long-term sobriety is so seductive. It's kind of like, hey, man, I've arrived. And what we've got, don't be lost on this, what we've got is the gifts of sobriety, right? We've got a lot of knowledge because we're older, and we've got these gifts of sobriety. And I lean back and I'm like, okay, so I'm pissed off because the pool boy put too much chlorine in my pool. Let me tell you something. A problem is a problem. I hope you have high-end problems. You should have high-end problems because you've been sober a long time. You've become a part of society. We are never problem-free, right? Okay. So then I misunderstood, and I thought that church was about finding God, right? This whole spiritual path, you know, sobriety is about growing spiritually and la, 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 la. And what I really understand today is that that AA is not about sobriety. AA is about getting a relationship with God, a God consciousness. And let me tell you, there's a lot being said in that. My buddy Chad told me that one, and I have just sat with that because, you know, when you hear a drunk speaking truth about our recovery process, you go, hold on. Say that again. Because we can hear it. It's that language of the heart, right? And so one of the things I want to caution you on there is identification, right? You can go to a meeting on fear, especially right now, and the whole topic can be about fear, and you leave that meeting with a level of relief, but you don't get freedom. And the relief is everybody's scared. Okay, well, I feel okay because everybody's scared. No, that's not the process. What we want you to do is not go to a meeting and get relief. We want you to go, if you're going to get your program from a meeting, we want you to go to a meeting and get freedom. This is so, so important. So how do you do that? Well, you got to write a fear inventory. And one of the things about long-term sobriety that's so seductive is we think we don't have to write inventory. And I'm telling you, I didn't write a piece of inventory. After my first overhaul, I didn't write another piece of inventory for 15 years. And let me tell you, that's dangerous. I didn't know that at the time because I'm doing all this counseling and I'm fixing self with self. And this is how that counseling looked, is like, say I was upset with somebody at my home group or at work. I'd go up to them and go, Mary, you know what? When you said that in front of all those people, that really, really hurt my feelings. It embarrassed me and it hurt my feelings, right? That's what you're learning to do, is to speak up for yourself. Now, I'm not saying that's not right, but that was my AA program. And Mary would go, oh, Katie, I am so sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I go, well, you did. And she goes, I am so sorry. And now she feels bad. And, well, I feel better. So that was what I did. And I thought that was the solution, right? So then we go to the church thing. And Joe says, I chased a boy into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 6 years sober and I had 10 minutes. Match made in heaven, if you ask me. And he was, it was so funny. He was a big book guy. And he said, he goes, Katie, this is all wrong. It's all wrong. And I'm like, shh, you know, come to the light, baby. Come to the light. And this is you boys. Next thing you know, we got you. There it is. And Joe and I, thank God, nobody was the arbiter of my sex life. You know, we were together for 20 years. We raised a family together, and absolutely was crazy about that man. We shared a lot of really cool things together. And this is what happens between 18 months and 3 years of sobriety. What ends up happening is, this is my observation. I sponsor half the goddamn country, so a lot of this is my experience. My buddy Lorenz tells me, you know, Katie, you gotta try to use that term. It's my experience a lot so that you aren't, you know, making people feel like I'm doing this. So let me tell you, I just said it one time and now I'm going on because I tend to forget it. So don't take it. Don't get up, get your ego all upset. So one of the things is that between 18 months and 3 years, that guy is where, and I say guy, you know who I'm talking about, guy, girl, whatever. They are working a program based on the abstinence of alcohol. Now they don't know that, nor did I. We don't know that, but you're working a program based on the abstinence of alcohol because everything is so new and so fresh. And oh my God, you get the gifts of sobriety. You go back to school and then you can get a house and you get a car and you get car insurance. And you know, all of that happens. But what happens is when they hit that wall in sobriety, they don't understand why they're hitting that wall. Now, I understand today that it's the second surrender, right? The surrender to self. They don't understand that, and they nod their head that they do, but they don't get it. And it's like it says in the third step, the first requirement is that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And let me tell you something. I didn't believe that because I was incredibly successful. I got everything in my life that I wanted. You want me to set this tool down for your lame old spiritual tool? I don't think so. No. I'll get what I need. And that's what I did. I did that forever. 17 years is when I hit that final wall. And I always like to say it's easier to get a drunk to quit drinking than it is to get one of us to quit playing God. So that guy does not know why he's at his home group and he thinks that guy's just an idiot. And oh, here goes Big Head Doug saying the same old crap he always says. And then before you know it, you know, I got to go. Got to go because the gifts of sobriety will pull you away. So at 3 years sober, Joe says to me, Joe always had 6 years more than me. So he has 9 years sober. I have 3 years sober. He goes, Katie, let's go to church. Go to church, whatever. I mean, I don't have anything against church, but I never really related to church. Nope, there I go again. Church people. And so I end up going, okay, fine, you know, we'll go to church. And he takes me, I was raised Catholic, nothing against that. I actually find when you say you're recovered Catholic, I think that's not a good choice. But I had nothing against Catholicism. I just didn't really feel anything. So he takes me into this church. And it's a non-denominational church. And it's got the music down, you know. I come walking in, and I was in the fitness business, and it was dance fitness. And I mean, I am like, whoa, I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God, that music spoke to my soul. And the next thing you know, we alcoholics are chameleons, right? Mark used to say we're like soybeans. We just take on the flavor of whatever. And the next thing you know, I'm in there and I am a sunbeam of Jesus. And I am all about it. And let me tell you something. What I misunderstood, don't get me wrong, I didn't say don't go to church, don't go to the ashram, don't kneel at the temple, none of that stuff. I just thought that AA was for not drinking, counseling was for my learning about self, and church was about my spiritual program. Now listen to this, Carl Jung and Roland Hazard. Carl Jung says that Roland Hazard needs a vital spiritual experience, but he's never been able to make one happen. And Roland Hazard says on page 27, upon hearing this, Roland heard that he needed a vital spiritual experience. Our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Wow. See, I didn't see any of that. Well, I wasn't reading the book. You know, that's how I don't see it. See, I didn't get that. So my whole, when I really woke up and saw what was happening in my life, my God, I was so blown away. See, I came out of the womb like Mighty Mouse. And I'm still very much like Mighty Mouse. Don't get me wrong. I'm better than I've ever been. My friend Lorenz has got me, he told me one time, I did a piece of inventory with him, and he said, Katie, you know, what would happen if you took the high road? And I remember thinking, well, I don't know. Never had. Don't even know how to get there. I mean, I'm like, oh my God, what is the high road? And so he started explaining it to me, but the coolest part was, is he said, what scares you so bad about not taking the high road. And I said, well, if not me, who? Who's gonna straighten out the injustice in the world, in the grocery store, on the hike and bike trip? Who's gonna take care of all the wrong? I mean, I'm throwing flags on the field everywhere I go. And he goes, oh, Katie, goes, there's plenty of people that will step in behind you. You don't have to be it. And I'm telling you, I've seen it. I've seen it incredible. We were at a conference somewhere, and the chair of the conference, it was several hundred people, and they weren't piping down. They weren't quieting down. Now tell me if you could be me here. They weren't quieting down, and the chairperson is talking just like they're quiet. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, somebody tell these people to shut up. And I thought, no, I'm a guest here. I'm one of the speakers. You don't need to be up there straightening out, you know, Illinois. You're going to be fine. And I'm sitting there, and it's making me crazy. And the next thing I know, my buddy that's the taper gets up there and gets one pudding and goes, everybody shut up. And I thought, oh, and they all shut up. And I went, well, that's what Lorenz was telling me. There is going to be somebody behind me to do this. I'm telling you, God will show up all the time. We're always thinking we got to have a burning bush. It's here this very moment, this given moment. Every breath I take is God directed, right? Now, my actions aren't all God directed. Every breath I take, if I can stay awake and aware, I misunderstood 10 and 11 like nobody's business, right? You know, watch for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear. And when these crop up, you know, ask God at once to remove it. You know, talk to somebody immediately, make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, and resolutely turn my thoughts to others. Heck, I thought the 10th step was the evening review for 17 years, and I wasn't doing it anyway. So what did it matter, right? I mean, there was so much I misunderstood. And when you got a personality like mine, where you come out of the womb like Mighty Mouse, my God, stand back. I always like to tell people, when you see my personality, you go, oh, well, you know, I can really see, you know, she is off the chain kind of gal, wants to run the whole show and everything, right? The book tells me I'm the actor running the whole show, forever trying to raise the light, scene rebellion. If everyone would do as I wish, the show would be great. Well, now, let me tell you something. If you happen to be what I call the ego turned inward, where you come into the room like a drone, right? You land, you're observing what's going on. You say nothing, you're up, and then you're out. Now, let me tell you something. That doesn't make you any less alcoholic than I am. It just means that my personality has got the obvious self-centered, and your personality is the silent self-centered. We are still equally as self-centered. You see, it's alcoholism we're dealing with here. The inventory process will show you how self shows up for you. And I've always, you know, people have always tried to label personalities as why they're alcoholic, the obviousness of alcoholic, like I did with Charlie. And today, my God, I understand things so differently. You know, I my mom died when I was 8, and I would have swore to God to you that's what made me alcoholic. I was the baby. My brother and sister, everybody was 2 years apart. That was 1958 when I was born. She died in 67. And one of the things about that is when I came into AA, I would have told you that made me alcoholic, because I thought something had to make you alcoholic. I didn't understand you got a genetic bullet. Today, I understand that. My sister doesn't have it. My brother doesn't have it. I have it. And but what I can tell you about that, my mom, when she died, my dad remarried 3 times in 18 months. I'll let you just absorb that. Yeah. Charlie likes to say, well, he could close the deal. That's no doubt about that. But we had 4 live-in housekeepers and 3 mothers. So what I understand today about that is it influenced my old ideas, right? Is my mom dying? Oh, yeah, that was terribly tragic. My dad remarrying all those times, really bizarre. But the truth of the matter is they influenced my old ideas. And my sister and I, who are very much alike, I mean, we are like twins separated by 18 months. The way she is in life and the way I am in life, we've got a lot of similarities, but we have a lot of things that are very different based on my mom dying. So where do I find these old ideas that are driving me? They're in a 3rd column of a 4-column resentment inventory. And they're either in a second column of a fear inventory. They're all over the conduct inventory. But you have to take these. So that tragedy influenced my old ideas on life, made me a very strong woman, right? And I never hated women. I never hated those mothers. So it's a very, very peculiar thing. I took my first drink at 12. I remember it like yesterday. I always find it funny when an alcoholic can't remember their first drink, because I tell you what that did for me was I never had that low self-worth that some people talk about. Ralph White and I, he was the only other speaker I ever heard that said he didn't have that low self-worth. I always just had this feeling that I was right. I can get this, get out of my way. I got this. And that just enhanced it even more. So imagine me in untreated alcoholism. Oh, I could pull a guy out of a car. I kind of did that, but we'll move on. So one of the things is that I took my first drink at 12, and let me tell you something, at 12, it's a little difficult to get booze, okay? So we'd go down to the 7-Eleven, me and my two girlfriends on our Schwinn bicycles, and we'd wait for the creepy guy, you know, the creepy guy. You wait for him to pull up, and I always love this because, you know, here we are, 12-year-old girls waiting for the creepy guy. We're not selling Girl Scout cookies, okay? We are seasoned 12-year-olds, and we're waiting for the creepy guy. And then yet we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're like, you know, so-and-so is bothering me. I'm like, oh, girl, tell him to buzz off. You know, what happened? We're alcoholic women. We can handle this. And if you are the ego turned inward and you can't, come find me. Okay? I will tell him to knock it off. And so the hardest thing we had was to get rid of the creepy guy, right? He'd go in there and go, I sure can get you some booze, girls. But he's in his car and we're on our bikes. We're heading for the woods, you know, got to lose him. And I got to tell you something, the creepy guy, oh, he's in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can sense that guy. And you know who you are, huh? Right, yeah. I even had one guy at one conference raise and go, I'm the creepy guy. I said, well, I like that way you're so forthcoming there. My dad and I bucked heads, right? I'm a budding alcoholic. I am just a little rebel. I'm a big fat liar. I don't want to come home ever. And my dad was so pissed off. He was so tired. And he finally just said, look, I was 15 years old. He said, if you can't live by the rules of this house, you can't live there. And to me, that was my exit plan. I'm like, dude, I am out. And I mean, I never came back home. Now, my dad and I patched some stuff up, but I never went back home. I was not about to. I convinced a woman to rent me a little house for $62.50 a month. I had to pay her $31.25 every 2 weeks. And I'm 15. I mean, who rents a house to a 15-year-old? That's what I'm telling you. That self-reliant tool worked for me. And I got my education. I got my diploma from high school. I didn't get anything close to an education because I just wasn't interested in school. There was a guy at our home group one time. Oh my God. He was from Norway, and one of my sponsees and I, we called each other dumb and dumber because we must have dyslexia. We got some learning disability. And she ended up going back to college, got her degree. Nobody was more proud of her than I was. College for me, no thank you. We'll do the inventory process to see if this is really where you want to go. And if it is, then you take it into prayer and meditation and you wait for God to tell you what the deal is. That's a whole nother ballgame. But this guy was from Norway and he's standing there. Oh my God, it was so funny. She goes, is he from Norwegian? And I said, silly, he is Norwegian. And I swear there's about 10 people standing around. They were all like, huh? I thought, oh, I think we both screwed that one up, you know? And then Charlie and I have been together for 17 years, and his whole family is a family of educators. Okay. That means they're all school teachers and they think they can change me. Well, you can't. Okay. I hope you're hearing this, honey. You can't. And so I'll tell Charlie, I'll say, you know, I don't know how to spell worth a flip. I comprehend poorly. I can read. Okay. But I comprehend poorly. And there you have it. And so I'll tell Charlie, I'll say, hey, honey, how do you spell such and such? He'll go, let's sound it out. And I'm like, oh yeah, those are fighting words. Let's sound it out my butt. Okay. We're moving on. My favorite one though is my daughter and I, she was living up at the Puget Sound up in Seattle in Washington State. And we're sitting there at the Puget Sound, and I start yawning, and I said, "Oh, honey, what is the altitude here? I am so tired." She goes, "Mother, this is sea level." And I said, "Yeah, but Mount Rainier is right over there." She goes, "You have to be on Mount Rainier for that to affect you." And I went, "Oh, okay. I got it now. I got it now." All I could think of was being in the sixth grade going, "What do you think they're learning in school? I got nothing. I got nothing." I mean, I'm telling you, I look back at that and I just think, oh my God. But I did have a blast. Well, okay, as I told you, Joe asked me, you know, I'm 3 years sober. Joe asked me about, let's go back to church. You know, I was the sunbeam of Jesus. I came back into AA trying to convert all my friends to Christianity. Let me tell you, thank God we've got the tradition that says, you know, please do not bring your religious convictions in here. Oh, my God, I ran everybody off. And Charlie, thank God he's my best friend, big old heathen that he was then. He was not about it. And Joe and I did the church thing for 3 years. And I mean, you know, you talk about take on the flavor of whatever you're at. You want to be in the junior league, you'll take on that look. You want to be the PE lady, PTA lady, you'll take on that look. You want to be in the motorcycle gang, you'll take on that look. That's just what we do. That's the nature of us. We think we blend. I always like to say, if you don't think you're self-centered, the next time you're out in the world, not in AA, but out in the world, and you say something, watch for this reaction. I mean, the world constantly goes, wow. And we think, it's just because I'm being so honest. No. They're shocked at what you're saying most of the time, just shocked at what you're saying. So one of the things about the church deal that was also interesting, Joe and I, we have a picture of us. We looked Amish. And I even started wearing underwear, if that gives you any indication of how we're blending, right? And one of the other things I can tell you, my dear friend Larsine, who you got to hear, I love me some Larsine. We decided we could be sisters, and she said, "Well, hair pulling sisters." I'm like, "Yeah. Yeah, what other sister do you have?" And she goes, "You know what? You alcoholics, none of you wear underwear. I don't know why. I don't know why that's not in your literature." It should be. But I love what it says in here. It says, on page 14, "For if an alcoholic failed to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not handle certain trials and low spots ahead." Well, let me tell you something. I don't know if certain trials and low spots ahead are you've been diagnosed with a bad illness or a flat tire, or you've lost your job. It's debatable. You know, in the fifth step, it says, "Is your foundation solid so far? Have you skimped on anything?" You know why? Because a tsunami is coming. Okay. You're delusional if you don't think you're going to have some serious stuff come at you. What is it that makes us believe that because we're sober, life should be okay? I don't know why, but we believe that. And it's an illusion that we have. And so I don't see this as you know, Joe and I are doing great. We've had another kid. Now we have two kids. We got a kid in college, but a kid in elementary school. We're, you know, tooling along. He's got his own business. I've been in the fitness business, been an athlete all my life. I get it. We're doing great. We have a cool little house, blah, 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 blah. And the next thing I know, we did the church thing for 3 years. And, Joe said to me, I'm not doing well, Katie. I said, "You know what? I'm not doing well either." And he goes, "Well," I said, "what do you think we should do?" And he goes, "We need to go back to AA." And we kept our AA friends. We were all about staying sober. And I said, "You know, you're absolutely right." So sure enough, we go back into our old home group. And there's all our friends. And I swear to God, that feeling, it was like, "My God, honey, we're home." I remember leaning over and just saying that to him. We took a deep breath, right? And what I didn't understand, oh my God, I'd love to tell you that we skipped down the yellow brick road from that day forward. But what I understand today that we did is we entered into what I call meeting-based sobriety, right? That's where we weren't working steps. We were trying to stay sober on AA meetings. How do you know what you don't know? I didn't know that. I thought that's what it was all about. I mean, we were sponsoring people. We were all about AA events. We were all about fellowship. And what ends up happening is, you know, our triangle has unity, service, recovery. Now, don't get me wrong. Unity is very important. Service is very important. But what treats alcoholism is the recovery process. So what we entered into is what I call untreated alcoholism. I didn't know that. We hadn't been doing 10 and 11, no disciplines. We were all about helping drunks. I don't know what we were giving them, but we weren't doing what was required. And so if you're not treating your alcoholism through the steps, right, the clear-cut directions that were designed to treat alcoholism, we're in untreated alcoholism. I mean, some people take such offense to that word. And I always go, well, then call it whatever the hell you want to call it. Call it dry, call it drifted, call it whatever you want. But if you are not doing a 10th step where you are watching for not just a damage control, taking that into your 11-step evening review, having made all your amends, let's not forget the importance of that. And then carrying that into on awakening. On awakening is not just sitting and reading spiritual literature. On awakening is looking at your 24 hours ahead, bringing the corrective measures from the day before into that, right? And then asking to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. What does that look like for you? Oh, let me tell you, I can't wait to hear about relationships in quarantine. It's like, holy smokes. I mean, I'm like, Charlie, I can't stand your breathing. Okay, it's that in and out thing you're doing and the chewing. It's killing me, dude. It's killing me. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure I'm bugging the crap out of him, but I can't see that. Blaming others as far as most of us ever got, right? So Joe and I enter into this, what I call untreated alcoholism. We don't know it. We are 5 meetings a week. We're doing this deal. And I like to call it stark raving sober. It says on page 25, if you are a serious alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into this region from which there is no return through human aid, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, we had but 2 alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. The book always gives me 2 options, right? Self-imposed crisis I can't postpone or evade. Either God's everything or he's nothing. No middle of the road solution, intolerable situation, or accept spiritual help. And deliberate manufacture of misery. God didn't do it. When trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize. It's always that. And let me tell you, when I'm in pain, the thought of spiritual help does not look like a good plan. So the next thing I know, Joe's not feeling well. And I mean to tell you, he's not doing well at all. And I can't figure out what the heck is going on. And I have my meeting I went to, 5 meetings a week. I'm raising my hand. You know, Joe's not doing well. I don't know what to do. We're not working a program. We don't have, you know, some of you guys may have a sponsor, but you're not using them. I mean, I don't care. I don't care how you package it. These are questions you got to ask yourself. Are you doing, are you treating your alcoholism? And I said, the doctor wants us to do some sort of testing and we both have catastrophic insurance. I have no clue how we're going to afford this, you know, and I'm just going on at the meeting. And one of my girlfriends pulls me aside and says, oh, Katie, she goes, you ought to drive a school bus. If you drive a school bus, you get an instant HMO. Now, that's great insurance for any of you guys that don't know what that is. And I'm like, well, let's do it. This is 1998. I'm in. And so I have a fitness business and, you know, it works. I own it. So I can be there whenever I need to. This bus job works perfect. Well, oh my God. Now, see, I'm the kind of gal who I am involved in self-reliance. If there's a problem, ask me. I'll fix it. Right? I'm here to take care of it. So what ended up happening is I go to get that school bus job. And let me tell you something. Everyone needs to drive a school bus. Okay. First and foremost, everyone needs to drive a school bus. It is unbelievable. And if you're the kind of person that gets behind a school bus and you get irritated, zip it, okay? Because that bus is full of children screaming, okay? You are the least of my worries back there. So I'm telling you what, I go get this school bus job and it was not easy to get. I had to take another test in front of, had to have a DPS driver in the goddamn bus with me. Oh my God, this was a challenging job to get, but I got it. And the next thing you know, boom, I got an instant HMO. I tell Joe, call the neurologist. Let's get all these tests run. There's something wrong with his head. And he calls the neurologist and the neurologist can't see him for 3 months. And I'm like, not on my watch. And I call my GP, my general practitioner. I said, hey, they can't see him for 3 months. He goes, go into the emergency room. They'll do all the tests you need, Katie. And so I tell Charlie, we're going to go in there and they're going to give you a gamut of tests, fail them. Now, are y'all with me on this? Please tell me you're as much of a con artist as I am. Okay. So I'm like, so fail them, Joe. So we drive over there, you know, we're in no big hurry. This isn't like he's got his leg cut off. We go over there, we get into the emergency room and I'm doing all the talking. And the doc goes, so you think something's wrong with his brain? I said, yeah, I know there is. And he goes, well, you know, Joe, touch your nose. And Joe touches his nose. He says, touch your elbow. And Joe touches his elbow. And I'm behind the doc going, what are you doing? Dude, you're supposed to be failing the test. And I'm thinking, oh my God, he's blowing the whole plan. And next thing you know, the doctor says, what's 2 + 2? And Joe was a high-end cabinet maker. He said, you know, doc, I should know that. And I don't. And the doc says, you know what, we're going to go ahead and have you run you through a gamut of tests. Oh my God, I just realized this battery's going down. Hey, Lizzie! Oh, never mind. Bear with me. Heavy part of the thing. Oh, technical difficulties. Okay, here I am. Okay, ready? So the doc says, we're going to run him through a gamut of tests. And so Joe and I are sitting there. And the next thing I know, the doc comes in. He puts his hand right here. And he goes, my God. He goes, he's got a brain tumor as big as my fist. And he must have said, my God, 3 times. And everything in my world stopped. And my very first thought was, oh, my God, I'm going to be driving this damn school bus forever. And let me tell you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to alcoholism. You see, our very first thought is typically pretty up. It's so self-centered. Now, I didn't say that to Joe. They go, oh, well, ain't that just great? I'm going to be driving this stupid bus. Joe, I crawled up in bed. We cried and cried and cried. He wasn't leaving that hospital. He was in that hospital for 11 days. The surgery was 14 hours. And I got to tell you something. That you talk about the incredible fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is amazing. I mean, between my fitness business and AA, they thought he was a movie star. We had so many people there. It's just, I could tell you so many wonderful stories. And I drove that goddamn school bus for 3 years. 3 years. And I am stark raving sober. I'm in untreated alcoholism. And I got to have this job because I can't lose the insurance. And let me tell you something. I could tell you 110 bus stories. Okay. My favorite two, and I only have about 8 minutes left. My favorite two are there. I was in a high-end neighborhood is what I drove the school bus for. And you know how kids are standing at the bus stops, you know, every several blocks. And there was a guy in a BMW. You know, that's all I needed was somebody that had, you know, a lot of money and pissed me off. And he's in his BMW and he used to just haul ass when he'd see my bus turn onto his street so that he could beat me before I got to all the kids at the stop. And it was dangerous. And I'm the sheriff of the world and not on my watch. And so I'd sit there at the end of the street and I'd wait for him to come. And he'd be sitting there looking at me like, is she coming? Is she going? What's she doing? And I wouldn't even come to a bus stop. And I would see this guy just, he'd haul ass. And right when he got to the front of my bus, I'd kick the door open and the stop sign would pop open like that, and he'd hit his brakes and he'd look up at me and he'd go, and I, who's got the power now, buddy? I swear to God, I was off the chain nuts, off the chain nuts. My favorite bus story, there's these two humps. When you go to the, you know, on the bus, the back end of a bus bounces up, right? I drove a gas bus. Why? Because they haul ass. Diesel buses don't go fast at all. And so I got these kids on the bus and I'm looking up there and they're always, Miss K, go fast, go fast. I said, hey guys, I can't do it. I'm going to get in trouble. And it was two humps and a stop. And then you took a right. And so I look up there one day and I think, hey, you know what? It's five boys. I mean, boys, you know, you can throw them out the bus window for God's sakes. One of them was my son. And so I go, okay, everybody to the back of the bus. And I mean, I gas it. And your life is in the mirror. And I'm looking up and I'm thinking, oh my God, we're getting air. And these kids are going higher and higher and higher. They hit the top of the goddamn roof of the bus. And I'm like, oh my God. You know that moment where you think, oh God, oh God, oh God, this is such a bad idea. And all of a sudden, when we came down, they dropped like rocks. I mean, I thought, oh my God, I've killed them all. And all you hear is just, right? And I'm thinking, what the hell was that? And the kids are like this, what was that? I go, I don't know what it was. And they, we get off the back of the bus, and we go to the back of the bus. And I look down there and I think, oh my God, I blew off all four valve stems off the back end of the bus. I got four flat tires. I am dead in the water. And those kids were like rats from a sinking ship. Not one of them was hurt. And it, right? So I got to call the bus barn and I get on the horn, you know, the radio, turtle bus to base, turtle bus to base. And they go, what's up, turtle bus? I go, God dang, Billy, I don't know what happened, man. I blew all four valve stems off the back end of my bus. And the big boss man carried a radio on his hip. He goes, you did what? I'm like, And he goes, we'll be there in 15 minutes. And I am standing there thinking, oh my God, I can't lose this job because I can't lose the insurance. And I'm 15 years sober. And let me tell you something. When they pulled up, my boss, who was a good man, he looked up the hill and he looked down there and he looked up the hill and he looked down there and he goes, you don't know what happened? I said, no, sir, I don't. He goes, okay. He said, Billy, take her back to the yard. And nothing was ever said. And I got to tell you, I'm embarrassed to say it took me 15 years to make an amends to that man. And it was the most moving and remarkable amends ever. Of course, I kept my job. But I got to tell you guys something. This untreated alcoholism that I was in, Joe's tumor was not cancer. He was going to live. And we had a hell of a life for 6 years, but we failed to enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. And Joe ended up going back out. And I'm telling you what, when he went back out, he went down the tubes so fast that he was a vibrant looking man. And he ended up looking like the guy flying the sign on the side of the road. And I mean no disrespect to that. I'm just giving you an image of what this man looked like in an 18-month period. And unfortunately, he ended up dying of a heroin overdose. We've been married 20 years, and I'm in untreated alcoholism, and I'm losing my mind. And I'd love to tell you I woke up to that right away. Of course, I did not wake up to that right away. I was angry as hell, and thank God for Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker was in untreated alcoholism, too, and there's nothing wrong with that. The purpose I say that is because even if you're in untreated alcoholism, as long as you get in the boat and stay in the boat, amazing things happen in your life. And Charlie drove me all these places because he'd had his plane crash. So he had his, you know, spiritual awakening. I was having a spiritual awakening following Charlie. The next thing I know, we meet Mark Houston. Our life radically changes, radically. And that's a whole story that unfortunately I don't have time to get into. But I'm here to tell you, I'm 35 years sober. I'm here to talk to the guy that's not feeling it between 3 years, 5 years, 15 years, 25 years. There is more available. Don't let your ego stand in the way. I like to call it middle management. I believe the new guy is the blood of AA, but the guy with time is the oxygen. The blood cannot survive without the oxygen. So please, if you're not in the book, get in the book. And if you are, I'll see you on the firing lines. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.